My mother bought into none of this. She'd lived in South Shore for 10 years already and would end up staying another 40. She didn't buy into fear-mongering and at the same time seemed equally inoculated against any sort of pie-in-the-sky idealism. She was a straight-down-the-line realist, controlling what she could. At Bryn Mawr, she became one of the most active members of the PTA, helping raise funds for new classroom equipment, throwing appreciation dinners for the teachers, and lobbying for the creation of a special multi-grade classroom that catered to higher-performing students. This last effort was the brainchild of Dr. Leviso, who'd gone to night school to get his PhD in education and had studied a new trend in grouping students by ability rather than by age. In essence, putting the brighter kids together so they could learn at a faster pace. The idea was controversial, criticized as being undemocratic, as all gifted and talented programs inherently are. But it was also gaining steam as a movement around the country, and for my last 3 years at Bryn Mawr, I was a beneficiary. I joined a group of about 20 students from different grades, set off in a self-contained classroom apart from the rest of the school, with our own recess, lunch, music, and gym schedules. We were given special opportunities, including weekly trips to a community college to attend an advanced writing workshop or dissect a rat in the biology lab. Back in the classroom, we did a lot of independent work, setting our own goals and moving at whatever speed best suited us. We were given dedicated teachers, first Mr. Martinez and then Mr. Bennett, both gentle and good-humored African-American men, both keenly focused on what their students had to say. There was a clear sense that the school had invested in us, which I think made us all try harder and feel better about ourselves. The independent learning setup only served to fuel my competitive streak. I tore through the lessons, quietly keeping tabs on where I stood among my peers as we charted our progress from long division to pre-algebra, from writing single paragraphs to turning in full research papers. For me, it was like a game. And as with any game, like most any kid, I was happiest when I was ahead. I told my mother everything that happened at school. Her lunchtime update was followed by a second update, which I'd deliver in a rush as I walked through the door in the afternoon, slinging my book bag on the floor and hunting for a snack. I realized I don't know exactly what my mom did during the hours we were at school, mainly because in the self-centered manner of any child, I never asked. I don't know what she thought about, how she felt about being a traditional homemaker as opposed to working a different job. I only knew that when I showed up at home, there'd be food in the fridge, not just for me, but for my friends. I knew that when my class was going on an excursion, my mother would almost always volunteer to chaperone, arriving in a nice dress and dark lipstick to ride the bus with us to the community college or the zoo. In our house, we lived on a budget, but didn't often discuss its limits. My mom found ways to compensate. She did her own nails, dyed her own hair, one time accidentally turning it green, and got new clothes only when my dad bought them for her as a birthday gift. She'd never be rich, but she was always crafty. When we were young, she magically turned old socks into puppets that looked exactly like the Muppets. She crocheted doilies to cover our tabletops. She sewed a lot of my clothes, at least until middle school, when suddenly it meant everything to have a Gloria Vanderbilt Swan label on the front pocket of your jeans, and I insisted she stop. Every so often, she changed the layout of our living room, putting a new slipcover on the sofa, swapping out the photos and framed prints that hung on our walls. When the weather turned warm, she did a ritualistic spring cleaning, attacking on all fronts, vacuuming furniture, laundering curtains, and removing every storm window so she could Windex the glass and wipe down the sills before replacing them with screens to allow the spring air into our tiny, stuffy apartment. She'd then often go downstairs to Robbie and Terry's, particularly as they got older and less able, to scour that as well. It's because of my mother that still to this day, I catch the scent of Pine Sol and automatically feel better about life. At Christmas time, she got especially creative. One year, she figured out how to cover our boxy metal radiator with corrugated cardboard printed to look like red bricks, stapling everything together so that we'd have a faux chimney that ran all the way to the ceiling and a faux fireplace, complete with a mantle and hearth. She then enlisted my father, the family's resident artist, to paint a series of orange flames on pieces of very thin rice paper, which, when backlit with a light bulb, made for a half-convincing fire. On New Year's Eve, as a matter of tradition, she'd buy a special hors d'oeuvre basket, the kind that came filled with blocks of cheese, smoked oysters in a tin, and different kinds of salami. She'd invite my dad's sister Francesca over to play board games. We'd order a pizza for dinner and then snack our way elegantly through the rest of the evening, my mom passing around trays of pigs in a blanket, fried shrimp, and a special cheese spread baked on Ritz crackers. As midnight drew close, we'd each have a tiny glass of champagne. My mother maintained the sort of parental mindset that I now recognize as brilliant and nearly impossible to emulate, a kind of unflappable Zen neutrality. I had friends whose mothers rode their highs and lows as if they were their own, and I knew plenty of other kids whose parents were too overwhelmed by their own challenges to be much of a presence at all. My mom was simply even-keeled. She wasn't too quick to judge, and she wasn't quick to meddle. Instead, she monitored our moods and bore benevolent witness to whatever travails or triumphs a day might bring. When things were bad, she gave us only a small amount of pity. When we'd done something great, we received just enough praise to know she was happy with us, but never so much that it became the reason we did what we did. Advice, when she offered it, tended to be of the hard-boiled and pragmatic variety. "You don't have to like your teacher," she told me one day after I came home spewing complaints, "but that woman's got the kind of math in her head that you need in yours. Focus on that and ignore the rest." She loved us consistently, Craig and me, but we were not overmanaged. Her goal was to push us out into the world. "I'm not raising babies," she'd tell us. "I'm raising adults." She and my dad offered guidelines rather than rules. It meant that as teenagers, we'd never have a curfew. Instead, they'd ask, "Well, what's a reasonable time for you to come home?" and then trust us to stick to our word. Craig tells a story about a girl he liked in eighth grade and how one day she issued a kind of loaded invitation, asking him to come by her house, pointedly letting him know that her parents wouldn't be home and they'd be left alone. My brother had privately agonized over whether to go or not, titillated by the opportunity, but knowing it was sneaky and dishonorable, the sort of behavior my parents would never condone. This didn't, however, stop him from telling my mother a preliminary half-truth, letting her know about the girl, but saying they were going to meet in the public park. Guilt-ridden before he'd even done it, guilt-ridden for even thinking about it, Craig finally confessed the whole Home Alone scheme, expecting or maybe just hoping that my mom would blow a gasket and forbid him to go. But she didn't. She wouldn't. It wasn't how she operated. She listened, but she didn't absolve him from the choice at hand. Instead, she returned him to his agony with a blithe shrug of her shoulders. "Handle it how you think best," she said before turning back to the dishes in the sink or the pile of laundry she had to fold. It was another small push out into the world. I'm sure that in her heart, my mother knew already that he'd make the right choice. Every move she made, I realize now, was buttressed by the quiet confidence that she'd raised us to be adults. Our decisions were on us. It was our life, not hers, and always would be. By the time I was 14, I basically thought of myself as half a grown-up anyway, maybe even as two-thirds of a grown-up. I got my period, which I announced immediately and with huge excitement to everyone in the house, because that was just the kind of household we had. I'd graduated from a training bra to one that looked vaguely more womanly, which also thrilled me. Instead of coming home for lunch, I now ate with my classmates in Mr. Bennett's room at school. Instead of dropping in at Southside's house on Saturdays to listen to his jazz records and play with Rex, I rode my bike right past, headed east to the bungalow on Oglesby Avenue, where the Gore sisters lived. The Gore sisters were my best friends and also a little bit my idols. Diane was in my grade and Pam a grade behind. Both were beautiful girls. Diane was fair-skinned and Pam was darker, each with a kind of self-possessed grace that seemed to come naturally. Even their little sister Gina, who was a few years younger, emanated a robust femininity that I came to think of simply as Gore-like. Theirs was a home with few men. Their father didn't live there and was rarely discussed. There was one much older brother who was a peripheral presence. Mrs. Gore was an upbeat, attractive woman who worked full-time. She had a makeup table laden with perfume bottles and face powder compacts and various ointments in tiny pots, which, given my mother's modest practicality, seemed as exotic as jewels to me. I loved spending time at their house. Pam, Diane, and I talked endlessly about which boys we liked. We put on lip gloss and took turns trying on one another's clothes, suddenly aware that certain pairs of pants made our hips look curvier. Much of my energy in those days was spent inside my own head, sitting alone in my room listening to music, daydreaming about a slow dance with a cute boy, or glancing out the window hoping for a crush to ride his bike down the block. So it was a blessing to have found some sisters to ride through these years with together. Boys weren't allowed inside the Gore house, but they buzzed around it like flies. They rode their bikes back and forth on the sidewalk. They sat on the front stoop hoping Diane or Pam might come out to flirt. It was fun to be around all this expectancy, even as I was unsure of what it all meant. Everywhere I looked, bodies were changing. Boys from school were suddenly man-sized and awkward, their energy twitchy and their voices deep. Some of my girlfriends, meanwhile, looked like they were 18, walking around in short shorts and halter tops, their expressions cool and confident, as if they knew some secret, as if they now existed on a different plane, while the rest of us remained uncertain and slightly dumbfounded, waiting for our call-up to the adult world, foal-like on our growing legs, and young in a way that no amount of lip gloss could yet fix. Like a lot of girls, I became aware of the liabilities of my body early, long before I began to even look like a woman. I moved around the neighborhood now with more independence, less tied to my parents. I'd catch a city bus to go to late afternoon dance classes at Mayfair Academy on 79th Street, where I was taking jazz and acrobatics. I ran errands for my mom sometimes. With the new freedoms came new vulnerabilities. I learned to keep my gaze fixed firmly ahead anytime I passed a group of men clustered on a street corner, careful not to register their eyes roving over my chest and legs. I knew to ignore the catcalls when they came. I learned which blocks in our neighborhood were thought to be more dangerous than others. I knew never to walk alone at night. At home, my parents made one major concession to the fact that they were housing two growing teenagers, renovating the back porch off our kitchen and converting it into a bedroom for Craig, who was now a sophomore in high school. The flimsy partition that Southside had built for us years earlier came down. I moved into what had been my parents' room. They rotated into what had been the kids' room, and for the first time, my brother and I had actual space for ourselves. My new bedroom was dreamy, complete with a blue and white floral bedskirt and pillow shams, a crisp navy blue rug, and a white princess-style bed with a matching dresser and lamp, a near-exact replica of a full-page bedroom layout I'd liked in the Sears catalog and been allowed to get. Each of us was given our own phone extension, too. My phone was a light blue to match my new decor, while Craig's was a manly black, which meant we could conduct our personal business semi-privately. I arranged my first real kiss, in fact, over the phone. It was with a boy named Ronell. Ronell didn't go to my school or live in my immediate neighborhood, but he sang in the Chicago Children's Choir with my classmate Chiaka. And with Chiaka acting as intermediary, we somehow had decided we liked each other. Our phone calls were a little awkward, but I didn't care. I liked the feeling of being liked. I felt a zing of anticipation every time the phone rang. Could it be Ronell? I don't remember which one of us proposed that we meet outside my house one afternoon to give kissing a try, but there was no nuance to it, no shy euphemisms needed to be applied. We weren't going to hang out or take a walk. We were going to make out, and we were both all for it, which is how I landed on the stone bench that sat near the side door of my family's house in full view of the south-facing windows and surrounded by my great-aunt's flower beds, lost in a warm, splishy kiss with Ronell. There was nothing earth-shattering or especially inspiring about it, but it was fun. Being around boys, I was slowly coming to realize, was fun. The hours I passed watching Craig's games from the bleachers of one gym or another began to feel less like a sisterly obligation, because what was a basketball game if not a showcase of boys? I'd wear my snuggish jeans and lay on some extra bracelets and sometimes bring one of the Gore sisters along to boost my visibility in the stands. And then I'd enjoy every minute of the sweaty spectacle before me, the leaping and charging, the rippling and roaring, the pulse of maleness and all its mysteries on full display. When a boy on the JV team smiled at me as he left the court one evening, I smiled right back. It felt like my future was just beginning to arrive. I was slowly separating from my parents, gradually less inclined to blurt every last thought in my head. I rode in silence behind them in the back seat of the Buick as we drove home from those basketball games, my feelings too deep or too jumbled to share. I was caught up in the lonely thrill of being a teenager now, convinced that the adults around me had never been there themselves. Sometimes in the evenings, I'd emerge from brushing my teeth in the bathroom and find the apartment dark, the lights in the living room and kitchen turned off for the night. Everyone settled into their own sphere. I'd see a glow beneath the door to Craig's room and know he was doing homework. I'd catch the flicker of television light coming from my parents' room and hear them murmuring quietly, laughing to themselves. Just as I never wondered what it was like for my mother to be a full-time at-home mother, I never wondered then what it meant to be married. I took my parents' union for granted. It was the simple, solid fact upon which all four of our lives were built. Much later, my mother would tell me that every year, when spring came and the air warmed up in Chicago, she entertained thoughts about leaving my father. I don't know if these thoughts were actually serious or not. I don't know if she considered the idea for an hour or for a day or for most of the season. But for her, it was an active fantasy, something that felt healthy and maybe even energizing to ponder, almost as ritual. I understand now that even a happy marriage can be a vexation, and it's a contract best renewed and renewed again, even quietly and privately, even alone. I don't think my mother announced whatever her doubts and discontents were to my father directly. And I don't think she let him in on whatever alternative life she might have been dreaming about during those times. Was she picturing herself on a tropical island somewhere, with a different kind of man, or in a different kind of house, or with a corner office instead of kids? I don't know, and I suppose I could ask my mother, who is now in her 80s, but I don't think it matters. If you've never passed a winter in Chicago, let me describe it. You can live for 100 straight days beneath an iron gray sky that claps itself like a lid over the city. Frigid, biting winds blow in off the lake. Snow falls in dozens of ways and heavy overnight dumps and daytime sideways squalls and demoralizing sloppy sleet and fairy tale billows of fluff. There's ice, usually lots of it, that shellacks the sidewalks and windshields that then need to be scraped. There's the sound of that scraping in the early mornings, the hack, hack, hack of it as people clear their cars to go to work. Your neighbors, unrecognizable in the thick layers they wear against the cold, keep their faces down to avoid the wind. City snowplows thunder through the streets as the white snow gets piled up and sooty until nothing is pristine. Eventually, however, something happens. A slow reversal begins. It can be subtle, a whiff of humidity in the air, a slight lifting of the sky. You feel it first in your heart, the possibility that winter might have passed. You may not trust it at the beginning, but then you do. Because now the sun is out, and there are little nubby buds on the trees, and your neighbors have taken off their heavy coats. And maybe there's a new airiness to your thoughts on the morning you decide to pull out every window in your apartment so you can spray the glass and wipe down the sills. It allows you to think, to wonder if you missed out on other possibilities by becoming a wife to this man in this house with these children. Maybe you spend the whole day considering new ways to live before finally you fit every window back into its frame and empty your bucket of Pine Sol into the sink. And maybe now all your certainty returns. Because yes, truly, it's spring, and once again, you've made the choice to stay. 5. My mother ultimately did go back to work, right about the time I began high school, catapulting herself out of the house and the neighborhood and into the dense skyscraper heart of Chicago, where she found a job as an executive assistant at a bank. She bought a work wardrobe and began commuting each morning, catching the bus north on Jeffrey Boulevard, or riding along with my dad in the Buick if their start times happened to line up. The job for her was a welcome shift in routine, and for our family it was also more or less a financial necessity. My parents had been paying tuition for Craig to go to Catholic school. He was starting to think about college, with me coming up right behind him. My brother was now full grown, a graceful giant with uncanny spring in his legs, and considered one of the best basketball players in the city. At home, he ate a lot. He drained gallons of milk, devoured entire large pizzas in one sitting, and often snacked from dinner to bedtime. He managed, as he'd always done, to be both easygoing and deeply focused, maintaining scads of friends and good grades while also turning heads as an athlete. He'd traveled around the Midwest on a summer rec league team that featured an incubating superstar named Isaiah Thomas, who would later go on to a Hall of Fame career in the NBA. As he approached high school, Craig had been sought after by some of Chicago's top public school coaches, looking to fill gaps in their rosters. These teams pulled in big rowdy crowds as well as college scouts, but my parents were adamant that Craig not sacrifice his intellectual development for the short-lived glory of being a high school phenom. Mount Carmel, with its Catholic League basketball team and rigorous curriculum, had been the best solution, worth the thousands of dollars it was costing my parents. Craig's teachers were brown-robed priests who went by Father. About 80% of his classmates were white, many of them Irish Catholic kids who came from outlying working-class white neighborhoods. By the end of his junior year, he was already being courted by Division I college teams, a couple of which would probably offer him a free ride. Still, my parents held fast to the idea that he should keep all options open, aiming to get himself into the best college possible. They alone would worry about the cost. My high school experience blessedly cost us nothing except for bus fare. I was lucky enough to test into Chicago's first magnet high school, Whitney M. Young High School, which sat in what was then a rundown area just west of the Loop and was, after a few short years in existence, on its way to becoming a top public school in the city. Whitney Young was named for civil rights activists and had been opened in 1975 as a positive-minded alternative to busing. Located squarely on the dividing line between the north and the south sides of the city, and featuring forward-thinking teachers and brand new facilities, the school was designed as a kind of equal opportunity nirvana, meant to draw high-performing students of all colors. Admissions quotas set by the Chicago School Board called for a student body that would be 40% Black, 40% white, and 20% Hispanic or other. But the reality of who enrolled looked slightly different. When I attended, about 80% of the students were non-white. Just getting to school for my first day of ninth grade was a whole new odyssey, involving 90 minutes of nerve-pummeling travel on two different city bus routes, as well as a transfer downtown. Hauling myself out of bed at 5 o'clock that morning, I'd put on all new clothes and a pair of nice earrings, unsure of how any of it would be received on the other end of my bus trek. I'd eaten breakfast, having no idea where lunch would be. I said goodbye to my parents, unclear on whether I'd even still be myself at the end of the day. High school was meant to be transformative, and Whitney Young, for me, was pure frontier. The school itself was striking and modern, like no school I'd ever seen, made up of three large cube-shaped buildings, two of them connected by a fancy-looking glass skyway that crossed over the Jackson Boulevard thoroughfare. The classrooms were open concept and thoughtfully designed. There was a whole building dedicated to the arts, with special rooms for the choir to sing and bands to play, and other rooms that had been outfitted for photography and pottery. The whole place was built like a temple for learning. Students streamed through the main entry, purposeful already on day one. There were about 1,900 kids at Whitney Young, and from my point of view, they appeared universally older and more confident than I'd ever be, in full command of every brain cell, powered by every multiple-choice question they'd nailed on the citywide standardized test. Looking around, I felt small. I'd been one of the older kids at Bryn Mawr, and now was among the youngest of the high schoolers. Getting off the bus, I noticed that along with their book bags, a lot of the girls carried actual purses. My worries about high school, if they were to be cataloged, could mostly be filed under one general heading: Am I good enough? It was a question that dogged me through my first month, even as I began to settle in, even as I got used to the pre-dawn wake-ups and navigating between buildings for class. Whitney Young was subdivided into five houses, each one serving as a home base for its members and meant to add intimacy to the big school experience. I was in the Gold House, led by an assistant principal named Mr. Smith, who happened to live a few doors down from my family on Euclid Avenue. I'd been doing odd jobs for Mr. Smith and his family for years, having been hired to do everything from babysitting his kids and giving them piano lessons to attempting to train their untrainable puppy. Seeing Mr. Smith at school was a mild comfort, a bridge between Whitney Young and my neighborhood, but it did little to offset my anxiety. Just a few kids from my neighborhood had come to Whitney Young. My neighbor and friend Terry Johnson had gotten in, and so had my classmate Chiaka, whom I'd known and been in friendly competition with since kindergarten, as well as one or two boys. Some of us rode the bus together in the mornings and back home at the end of the day, but at school we were scattered between houses, mostly on our own. I was also operating for the first time ever without the tacit protection of my older brother. Craig, in his ambling and smiley way, had conveniently broken every trail for me. At Bryn Mawr, he softened up the teachers with his sweetness and earned a certain cool kid respect on the playground. He'd created sunshine that I could then just step into. I had always, pretty much everywhere I'd gone, been known as Craig Robinson's little sister. Now, though, I was just Michelle Robinson with no Craig attached. At Whitney Young, I had to work to ground myself. My initial strategy involved keeping quiet and trying to observe my new classmates. Who were these kids anyway? All I knew was that they were smart, demonstrably smart, selectively smart. The smartest kids in the city, apparently. But wasn't I as well? Hadn't all of us, me and Terry and Chiyoka, landed here because we were smart like them? The truth is, I didn't know. I had no idea whether we were smart like them. I knew only that we were the best students coming out of what was thought to be a middling, mostly black school in a middling, mostly black neighborhood. But what if that wasn't enough? What if, after all this fuss, we were just the best of the worst? This was the doubt that sat in my mind through student orientation, through my first sessions of high school biology and English, through my somewhat fumbling get-to-know-you conversations in the cafeteria with new friends. Not enough. Not enough. It was doubt about where I came from and what I'd believed about myself until now. It was like a malignant cell that threatened to divide and divide again, unless I could find some way to stop it. Chicago, I was learning, was a much bigger city than I'd ever imagined it to be. This was a revelation formed in part over the 3 hours I now log daily on the bus, boarding at 75th Street and chuffing through a maze of local stops, often forced to stand because it was too crowded to find a seat. Through the window, I got a long view of the South Side and what felt like its entirety. Its corner stores and barbecue joints still shuttered in the gray light of early morning, its basketball courts and paved playgrounds lying empty. We'd go north on Jeffrey, and then west on 67th Street, then north again, zagging and stopping every two blocks to collect more people. We crossed Jackson Park Highlands and Hyde Park, where the University of Chicago campus sat hidden behind a massive wrought iron gate. After what felt like an eternity, we finally accelerated onto Lakeshore Drive, following the curve of Lake Michigan north toward downtown. There's no hurrying a bus ride, I can tell you. You get on and you endure. Every morning, I'd switch buses downtown at Michigan Avenue at the height of rush hour, catching a westbound ride along Van Buren Street, where the view at least got more interesting as we passed bank buildings with big gold doors and bellhops standing outside the fancy hotels. Through the window, I watched men and women in smart outfits, in suits and skirts and clicking heels, carrying their coffee to work with a bustle of self-importance. I didn't yet know that people like this were called professionals. I hadn't yet tracked the degrees they must have earned to gain access to the tall corporate castles lining Van Buren, but I did like how determined they looked. Meanwhile, at school, I was quietly collecting bits of data, trying to sort out my place inside the teenage intelligentsia. Until now, my experiences with kids from other neighborhoods had been limited to visits with various cousins and a few summers of city-run day camp at Rainbow Beach, where every camper still came from some part of the South Side and nobody was well off. At Whitney Young, I met white kids who lived on the north side, a part of Chicago that felt like the dark side of the moon, a place I'd never thought about nor had reason to go to. More intriguing was my early discovery that there was such a thing as an African-American elite. Most of my new high school friends were black, but that didn't necessarily translate, it turned out, to any sort of uniformity in our experience. A number of them had parents who were lawyers or doctors and seemed to know one another through an African-American social club called Jack and Jill. They'd been on ski vacations and trips that required passports. They talked about things that were foreign to me, like summer internships and historically black colleges. One of my black classmates, a nerdy boy who was always kind to everyone, had parents who'd founded a big beauty supply company and lived in one of the ritziest high-rises downtown. This was my new world. It's not to say that everyone at the school was rich or overly sophisticated, because that wasn't the case. There were plenty of kids who came from neighborhoods just like mine, who struggled with far more than I ever would. But my first months at Whitney Young gave me a glimpse of something that had previously been invisible, the apparatus of privilege and connection, what seemed like a network of half-hidden ladders and guide ropes that lay suspended overhead, ready to connect some, but not all of us, to the sky. My first round of grades at school turned out to be pretty good, and so did my second. Over the course of my freshman and sophomore years, I began to build the same kind of confidence I had at Bryn Mawr. With each little accomplishment, with every high school screw-up I managed to avoid, my doubts slowly took leave. I liked most of my teachers. I wasn't afraid to raise my hand in class. At Whitney Young, it was safe to be smart. The assumption was that everyone was working toward college, which meant that you never hid your intelligence for fear of someone saying you talk like a white girl. I loved any subject that involved writing and labored through pre-calc. I was a half-decent French student. I had peers who were always a step or two ahead of me, whose achievements seemed effortless, but I tried not to let that get to me. I was beginning to understand that if I put in extra hours of studying, I could often close the gap. I wasn't a straight-A student, but I was always trying, and there were semesters when I got close. Craig, meanwhile, had enrolled at Princeton University, vacating his back porch room on Euclid Avenue, leaving a 6'6", 200-pound gap in our daily lives. Our fridge was considerably less loaded with meat and milk, the phone line no longer tied up by girls calling to chat him up. He'd been recruited by big universities offering scholarships and what amounted to a celebrity existence playing basketball. But with my parents' encouragement, he'd chosen Princeton, which cost more, but as they saw it, promised more as well. My father burst with pride when Craig became a starter as a sophomore on Princeton's basketball team, wobbly on his feet and using two canes to walk. He still relished a long drive. He traded in his old Buick for a new Buick, another 225, this one a shimmering deep maroon. When he could get the time off from his job at the filtration plant, he'd drive 12 hours across Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey to catch one of Craig's games. By nature of my long commute to Whitney Young, I saw less of my parents, and looking back at it, I guess that it was a lonely time for them, or at least required some adjustment. I was now gone more than I was home, tired of standing through the 90-minute bus ride to school. Terry Johnson and I had figured out a kind of trick, which involved leaving our houses 15 minutes earlier in the morning and catching a bus that was headed in the opposite direction from school. We rode a few stops south to a less busy neighborhood, then jumped out, crossed the street, and hailed our regular northbound bus, which was reliably emptier than it would be at 75th, where we normally boarded. Pleased by our own cleverness, We'd smugly claim a seat and then talk or study the whole way to school. In the evenings, I dragged myself back through the door around 6 or 7 o'clock, in time for a quick dinner and a chance to talk to my parents about whatever had gone on that day. But once the dishes had been washed, I disappeared into homework, often taking my books downstairs to the encyclopedia nook off the stairwell next to Robbie and Terry's apartment for privacy and quiet. My parents never once spoke of the stress of having to pay for college, but I knew enough to appreciate that it was there. When my French teacher announced that she'd be leading an optional class trip to Paris over one of our breaks for those who could come up with the money to do it, I didn't even bother to raise the issue at home. This was the difference between me and the Jack and Jill kids, many of whom were now my close friends. I had a loving and orderly home, bus fare to get me across town to school, and a hot meal to come home to at night. Beyond that, I wasn't going to ask my parents for a thing. Yet one evening, my parents sat me down looking puzzled. My mother had learned about the France trip through Terry Johnson's mom. "Why didn't you tell us?" she said. "Because it's too much money." "That's actually not for you to decide, Mish," my dad said gently, almost offended. "And how are we supposed to decide if we don't even know about it?" I looked at them both, unsure of what to say. My mother glanced at me, her eyes soft. My father had changed out of his work uniform and into a clean white shirt. They were in their early 40s then, married nearly 20 years. Neither one of them had ever vacationed in Europe. They never took beach trips or went out to dinner. They didn't own a house. We were their investment, me and Craig. Everything went into us. A few months later, I boarded a flight to Paris with my teacher and a dozen or so of my classmates from Whitney Young. We would stay in a hostel, tour the Louvre and the Eiffel Tower. We'd buy crepes à fromage from stands on the street and walk along the banks of the Seine. We'd speak French like a bunch of high school kids from Chicago, but we'd at least speak French. As the plane pulled away from its gate that day, I looked out my window and back at the airport, knowing that my mother stood somewhere behind its black glass windows, dressed in her winter coat and waving me on. I remember the jet engines firing shockingly loud. And then we were rattling down the runway and beginning to tilt upward as the acceleration seized my chest and pressed me backward into my seat for that strange, in-between half moment that comes before finally you feel lifted. In the manner of all high schoolers everywhere, my friends and I liked to loiter. We loitered boisterously and we loitered in public. On days when school got out early or when homework was light, we flocked from Whitney Young to downtown Chicago, landing in the 8-story mall at Water Tower Place. Once there, we rode the escalators up and down, spent our money on gourmet popcorn from Garrett's, and commandeered tables at McDonald's for more hours than was reasonable, given how little food we ordered. We browsed the designer jeans and the purses at Marshall Field's, often surreptitiously tailed by security guards who didn't like the look of us. Sometimes we went to a movie. We were happy. Happy with our freedom, happy with one another, happy with the way the city seemed to glitter more on days when we weren't thinking about school. We were city kids learning how to range. I spent a lot of my time with a classmate named Santita Jackson, who in the mornings boarded the Jeffrey bus a few stops after I did, and who became one of my best friends in high school. Santita had beautiful dark eyes, full cheeks, and the bearing of a wise woman, even at 16. At school, she was one of those kids who signed up for every AP class available and seemed to ace them all. She wore skirts when everyone else wore jeans, and had a singing voice so clear and powerful that she'd end up touring years later as a backup singer for Roberta Flack. She was also deep. It's what I loved most about Santita. Like me, she could be frivolous and goofy when we were with a larger group, but on our own, we'd get ponderous and intense. Two girl philosophers together trying to sort out life's issues, big and small. We passed hours sprawled on the floor of Santita's room on the second floor of her family's white Tudor house in Jackson Park Highlands, a more affluent section of South Shore, talking about things that irked us and where our lives were headed and what we did and didn't understand about the world. As a friend, she was a good listener and insightful, and I tried to be the same. Santita's father was famous. This was the primary impossible-to-get-around fact of her life. She was the eldest child of the Reverend Jesse Jackson, the firebrand Baptist preacher and increasingly powerful political leader. Jackson had worked closely with Martin Luther King Jr. and risen to national prominence himself in the early 1970s as the founder of a political organization called Operation Push, which advocated for the rights of underserved African Americans. By the time we were in high school, he'd become an outright celebrity, charismatic, well-connected, and constantly on the move. He toured the country, mesmerizing crowds with thundering calls for Black people to shake off the undermining ghetto stereotypes and claim their long-denied political power. He preached a message of relentless, let's do this self-empowerment. Down with dope, up with hope, he'd call to his audiences. He had school kids sign pledges to turn off the TV and devote 2 hours to their homework each night. He made parents promise to stay involved. He pushed back against the feelings of failure that permeated so many African-American communities, urging people to quit with the self-pity and take charge of their own destiny. Nobody but nobody, he'd yell, is too poor to turn off the TV 2 hours a night. Hanging around Santita's house could be exciting. The place was roomy and a little chaotic, home to the family's 5 children and stuffed with heavy Victorian furniture and antique glassware that Santita's mom, Jacqueline, liked to collect. Mrs. Jackson, as I called her, had an expansive spirit and a big laugh. She wore colorful, billowy clothes and served meals at a massive table in the dining room, hosting anyone who turned up, mostly people who belonged to what she called the movement. This included business leaders, politicians, and poets, plus a coterie of famous people, from singers to athletes. When Reverend Jackson was at home, a different energy pulsed through the house. Routines were cast aside. Dinner conversations lasted late into the night. Advisors came and went. Plans were always being made. Unlike in my apartment on Euclid, where life ran at an orderly and predictable pace, where my parents' concerns rarely extended beyond keeping our family happy and on track for success, the Jacksons seemed caught in something larger, messier, and seemingly more impactful. Their engagement was outward. Their community was big. Their mission, important. Santita and her siblings were being raised to be politically active. They knew how and what to boycott. They marched for their father's causes. They went on his work trips, visiting places like Israel and Cuba, New York and Atlanta. They stood on stages in front of big crowds and were learning to absorb the anxiety and controversy that came with having a father, maybe especially a Black father, in public life. Reverend Jackson had bodyguards, large silent men who traveled with him. At the time, it only half registered with me that there had been threats against his life. Santita adored her father and was proud of his work, but she was also trying to live her own life. She and I were all for strengthening the character of Black youth across America, but we also needed rather desperately to get to Water Tower Place before the K-Swiss sneaker sale ended. We often found ourselves looking for rides or to borrow a car. Because I lived in a one-car family with 2 working parents, the odds were usually better at the Jackson's house, where Mrs. Jackson had both a wooden-paneled station wagon and a little sports car. Sometimes we'd hitch rides with the various staff members or visitors who buzzed in and out. What we sacrificed was control. This would become one of my early unwitting lessons about life in politics. Schedules and plans never seem to stick. Even standing on the far edge of the vortex, you still felt its spin. Santita and I were often stuck waiting out some delay that related to her father, a meeting that was running long, or a plane that was still circling the airport, or detouring through a series of last-minute stops. We'd think we were getting a ride home from school or going to the mall, but instead we'd end up at a political rally on the West Side or stranded for hours at the Operation Push headquarters in Hyde Park. One day, we found ourselves marching with a crowd of Jesse Jackson supporters in the Bud Billiken Day Parade, the parade, named for a fictional character from a long-ago newspaper column, is one of the South Side's grandest traditions, held every August, an extravaganza of marching bands and floats that runs for almost 2 miles along Martin Luther King Jr. Drive, through the heart of the African-American neighborhood that was once referred to as the Black Belt, but was later rechristened Bronzeville. The Bud Billiken Day Parade had been going on since 1929 and was all about African-American pride. If you were any sort of community leader or politician, it was and still is to this day more or less mandatory that you show up and walk the route. I didn't know it at the time, but the vortex around Santita's father was starting to spin faster. Jesse Jackson was a few years from formally launching a run to be president of the United States, which means he was likely beginning to actively consider the idea during the time we were in high school. Money had to be raised. Connections needed to be made. Running for president, I understand now, is an all-consuming, full-body effort for every person involved. And good campaigns tend to involve a stage-setting, groundwork-laying preamble, which can add whole years to the effort. Setting his sights on the 1984 election, Jesse Jackson would become the second African-American ever to run a serious national campaign for the presidency, after Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm's unsuccessful run in 1972. My guess is that at least some of this was on his mind at the time of the parade. What I knew was that I personally didn't love the feeling of being out there, thrust under a baking sun, amid balloons and bullhorns, amid trombones and throngs of cheering people. The fanfare was fun and even intoxicating, but there was something about it, and about politics in general, that made me queasy. For one thing, I was someone who liked things to be neat and planned in advance, and from what I could tell, there seemed to be nothing especially neat about life in politics. The parade had not been part of my plan. As I remember it, Santita and I hadn't intended on joining at all. We'd been conscripted at the last minute, maybe by her mother or father, or maybe someone else in the movement who'd caught us before we could follow through on whatever ideas we'd had for ourselves that day. But I loved Santita dearly, and I was also a polite kid who, for the most part, went along with what adults told me to do. And so I'd done it. I'd plunged myself deep into the hot, spinning noisiness of the Bud Billiken Day Parade. I arrived home at Euclid Avenue that evening to find my mother laughing. "I just saw you on TV," she said. She'd been watching the news and spotted me marching alongside Santita, waving and smiling and going along. What made her laugh, I'd guess, is that she also picked up on the queasiness, the fact that maybe I'd been caught up in something I'd rather not do. When it came time to look at colleges, Santita and I both were interested in schools on the East Coast. She went to check out Harvard, but was disheartened when an admissions officer pointedly harassed her about her father's politics, when all she wanted was to be taken on her own terms. I spent a weekend visiting Craig at Princeton, where he seemed to have slipped into a productive rhythm of playing basketball, taking classes, and hanging out at a campus center designed for minority students. The campus was large and pretty, an Ivy League school covered with ivy, and Craig's friends seemed nice enough. I didn't overthink it from there. No one in my immediate family had much in the way of direct experience with college, so there was little, anyway, to debate or explore. As had always been the case, I figured that whatever Craig liked, I would like too, and whatever he could accomplish, I could as well. And with that, Princeton became my top choice for school. Early in my senior year at Whitney Young, I went for an obligatory first appointment with the school college counselor to whom I'd been assigned. I can't tell you much about the counselor because I deliberately and almost instantly blotted this experience out. I don't remember her age or race or how she happened to look at me that day when I turned up in her office doorway, full of pride at the fact that I was on track to graduate in the top 10% of my class at Whitney Young, that I'd been elected treasurer of the senior class, made the National Honor Society, and managed to vanquish pretty much every doubt I'd arrived with as a nervous ninth grader. I don't remember whether she inspected my transcript before or after I announced my interest in joining my brother at Princeton the following fall. It's possible, in fact, that during our short meeting, the college counselor said things to me that might have been positive and helpful, but I recall none of it, because rightly or wrongly, I got stuck on one single sentence the woman uttered. "I'm not sure," she said, giving me a perfunctory, patronizing smile, "that you're Princeton material." Her judgment was as swift as it was dismissive, probably based on a quick-glance calculus involving my grades and test scores. It was some version, I imagine, of what this woman did all day long with practice efficiency, telling seniors where they did and didn't belong. I'm sure she figured she was only being realistic. I doubt that she gave our conversation another thought. But as I've said, failure is a feeling long before it's an actual result. And for me, it felt like that's exactly what she was planting, a suggestion of failure long before I'd even tried to succeed. She was telling me to lower my sights, which was the absolute reverse of every last thing my parents had ever told me. Had I decided to believe her, her pronouncement would have toppled my confidence all over again, reviving the old thrum of not enough, not enough. But 3 years of keeping up with the ambitious kids at Whitney Young had taught me that I was something more. I wasn't going to let one person's opinion dislodge everything I thought I knew about myself. Instead, I switched my method without changing my goal. I would apply to Princeton and a scattershot selection of other schools, but without any more input from the college counselor. Instead, I sought help from someone who actually knew me. Mr. Smith, my assistant principal and neighbor, had seen my strengths as a student and furthermore trusted me with his own kids. He agreed to write me a recommendation letter. I've been lucky enough now in my life to meet all sorts of extraordinary and accomplished people, world leaders, inventors, musicians, astronauts, athletes, professors, entrepreneurs, artists and writers, pioneering doctors and researchers. Some, though not enough of them, are women. Some, though not enough, are Black or of color. Some were born poor or have lived lives that to many of us would appear to have been unfairly heaped with adversity, and yet still they seem to operate as if they've had every advantage in the world. What I've learned is this. All of them have had doubters. Some continue to have roaring stadium-sized collections of critics and naysayers who will shout, "I told you so," at every little misstep or mistake. The noise doesn't go away, but the most successful people I know have figured out how to live with it, to lean on the people who believe in them, and to push onward with their goals. That day, I left the college counselor's office at Whitney Young. I was fuming, my ego bruised more than anything. My only thought in that moment was, I'll show you. But then